Well, we come to our second echo of George MacDonald from the past, this time from the Gospel of Mark. Now, if you turn to the little pamphlet of Bible readings that Ralph has kindly prepared, you'll see I was originally intending to speak on quite a long passage, Mark 9:30 to 50, but discretion is the better part of virtue. I've had mercy on you and myself, and we're going to actually just look at the section which MacDonald himself deals with, which is verses 33 to 41. So I'm starting to read at Mark 9, verse 33, and finishing at verse 41. Let's hear the word of God. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, "What were you arguing about on the road?" They kept quiet because on the way they had argued about who was the greatest. Sitting down, Jesus called the 12 and said, "If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all." He took a little child and had him stand among them. Taking him in his arms, he said to them, "Whoever welcomes one of these little children in my name welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me does not welcome me, but the one who sent me." "Teacher," said John, "we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he was not one of us." "Do not stop him," Jesus said. "No one who does a miracle in my name can in the next moment say anything bad about me, for whoever is not against us is for us. I tell you the truth, anyone who gives you a cup of water in my name because you belong to Christ will certainly not lose his reward." Some years ago, the theologian Tom Wright, who's now Bishop of Durham, told me a rather amusing story. At least I thought it was amusing, you may not, because it concerns a party of American tourists in London. One of them happened to know a Member of Parliament, and this was a great advantage visiting the Houses of Parliament in Westminster, because if you know an insider, you can go and see behind the scenes in a way they never let the members of the public normally. So they were having their special guided tour by their Member of Parliament friend around the corridors at the back of Westminster. And I think they were finding such close contact with the cradle of democracy a bit emotionally overwhelming. Anyway, at one point, you must imagine their awe-struck excitement when who should appear from a doorway in the corridor they were walking down but Lord Hailsham. May not be a name familiar to you, but he was an extremely important and prominent politician back in the late 70s, early 80s. And he was splendidly attired for some ceremonial engagement. At that time, he held the office of Lord Chancellor of England. And with this went a lot of silk robes and gold chains and rings and goodness knows what else. And he was all kitted out for something that he had to do in this role as he came into the corridor, which stunned these poor American tourists, as you can imagine, even more. Well, as Lord Hailsham walked towards the tourists, he happened to spy, looking over their heads in the corridor behind them, a colleague. This was the leader of the opposition at that time, the leader of the Labour Party, whose name was Neil Kinnock. He wanted to attract the attention of his parliamentary colleague. So he held up his hand and he said, "Neil!" Whereupon, according to the story, several of the American tourists dropped to one knee. Now, I'm sure this story is heavily embroidered, and I do not tell it to score points off American tourists, but simply to illustrate how incongruous it seems to us these days, to show obeisance to a superior. We've all laughed, but there was a time when kneeling to the Lord Chancellor of England would have been a perfectly natural thing to do. It's now so ridiculous, we find it amusing. The class system in the UK still survives, of course, but it is only a pale shadow of what it once was. And to give credit where credit is due, you Americans have done more than most to undermine the class system in the Western world. Whenever I hear a man arguing for slavery, said your Abraham Lincoln, I feel a strong desire to see it tried on him personally. When he first said it, it would have been, a controversial statement. But now, a century and a half later, it's impossible to imagine anybody disagreeing with such a sentiment. Equality is our great watchword. Social stratification is wrong. We don't kneel, therefore, to anybody these days. Or if we do, it's only in the context of antiquated ceremonial and with our tongue firmly in our cheek. The very idea of inferior rank, of being somebody's slave, it's completely unacceptable to us. For the great preoccupation of men and women in our 21st century culture is self-esteem. We don't bow the knee to anybody. The people we admire most are the people nobody bosses around. The person who knows their rights and sticks up for them. The person who asserts themselves and won't be patronized. Which is all very well, but it makes it a little hard for us to engage with this text from Mark 9. Though, one has to say, it would have been hard for Jesus' original hearers to engage with it too. It's popular to suggest that the greatest contribution Jesus made to ethics was the emphasis he put on love. And as we saw in our first study this morning, his exposition of love was pretty radical, embracing as it did not only love for friends, but love for enemies. But I suspect for many of his contemporaries, it was not actually what Jesus said about love which was the most novel and extraordinary feature of his teaching. Other rabbis had also identified love of neighbor as the key commandment. No, I think it was what Jesus said about humility, which was really revolutionary, really countercultural. For first century people were just as concerned about their self-esteem, I think, as we are today. The role of slave was considered just as demeaning. The heroes of the ancient world were without exception men of aggression and self-assertion. They were great soldiers. Or they were great athletes, or they were great orators. They were men who had won praise by the victories they had won over their opponents. That was what it meant to be a real man in those days. You could never admire a slave. A slave was a cowardly dog with his tail between his legs. A slave was a cringing, snivelling nobody. In the Greco-Roman world, they didn't even pretend to regard humility as a virtue. In their catalogue of character, humility was a vice. It was indistinguishable from servility. It was a despicable sign of weakness. To suggest, therefore, the pathway to heaven consisted in adopting a humble mindset, why, it was about as crazy to one of Jesus' contemporaries as suggesting they dig a tunnel to the moon. And yet Jesus did assert this repeatedly. Again and again we find him in the Gospels trying to establish this paradoxical link between greatness and humility. Blessed are the meek, he said. They will inherit the earth. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am meek and lowly of heart. There was that time, I'm sure you recall, when, to the intense embarrassment of the 12, he took a towel and washed their feet, the action of a servant, of a slave, a menial, "You call me master and lord," he said. "Well, I have set you an example that you should wash one another's feet. You know that those who are regarded as leaders in the world lord it over others, but not with you. Whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant." But never, I think, in all the gospel narrative, does Jesus make this point about greatness and humility with more graphic power, more emotional power, than on this occasion here, recorded by Mark, when he took a little child and had them stand in the midst. "Unless you become like little children," he said, "you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child, he is the greatest in the kingdom." Now, Mark tells us that the background to this incident was that they had been travelling through Galilee, and it hadn't been a very amicable journey, because the disciples had been arguing on the way about social precedence. Now, one of the ways you displayed your social rank in those days was by making sure you were seen standing or sitting in close proximity to a big man. I suppose it's the same today, isn't it? Anybody who's seen on the television standing shoulder to shoulder with the president, or in my country with the member of the royal family or the prime minister, this is an immense honour. Immediately your kudos rating rises. Well, in those days, in the Jewish community, it was those who sat nearest the rabbi who got the kudos. So the seats in the synagogue that were closest to where the rabbi sat were the high prestige seats. And when the rabbi was going along the road with his entourage, those who were standing next to him, with whom he exchanged friendly banter on the way, these were clearly number one disciples. Well, these disciples of Jesus not unnaturally assumed a similar protocol would prevail in Jesus' community, in the kingdom of God. So as they walked along the narrow lanes of Galilee, they engaged in some rather unseemly jockeying for position, competing for the places closest to Jesus. It's not difficult to imagine, is it, the sort of banter that was going on. "Hey, James, get back in line. I go in front of you." "What do you mean, Philip? It wasn't you he took up on the Mount of Transfiguration, was it?" "Shut up, both of you. Everyone knows it's me, Peter, who is supposed to be the leader. I confessed him as the Christ before any of you." "Yeah, and got called an instrument of Satan in the next breath, as I recall." So the bickering and the jostling went on. And clearly, Jesus noticed and got steadily more annoyed by it. He had, in fact, tolerated a good deal from his disciples during the time they had been together. One of the distinctive features of Mark's gospel, those of you who study the synoptic gospels may be aware of this, one of the features of Mark's gospel is that the evangelist highlights how frequently Jesus has been exasperated by his disciples' lack of insight. And this is one more example of it. It must have been particularly galling at this late stage in his ministry because, of course, the horizon now is becoming increasingly darkened by the shadow of the cross. And yet, as what lies ahead is beginning to dominate Jesus' mental horizons, here they are, who should have been supporting him, engaging in petty argument and rivalry. Now, this time he decides he will not suffer in silence. He confronts them about it and answers the guilty silence that follows his words with this stunning object lesson of the child in the midst that must have remained rooted in their memory forever. How could they ever forget this visual aid? I think it was a scene, too, that made a powerful impact on George MacDonald. He was a man, we know, who was enthralled by the fantasy world in which children love to be entertained. And some of his best books, as Ralph was reminding us, are actually fantasy novels, in part at least intended for children. So perhaps it's no surprise, that being so, that MacDonald chose his sermon on this passage and on this theme to appear as the very first chapter of his unspoken sermons. He entitled it, "The Child in the Midst." And in that sermon, he depicts, in quite a moving way, the the touching way in which Jesus enacts this visual parable, wrapping his arms around the child. I think it's as if Jesus is saying, I know what you've been arguing about. You're jealous of one another. You all want to be closest to me. Well, now I'll make you all jealous. Look who's really close to me. Look who really shares the intimate relationship with me. If you want to win the position of honour, welcome this child. If you want to be first, be willing to be last. The picture is all the more remarkable, I think, when you realise just how disregarded children were in the ancient world. Today, there are many senses in which the child has become very central to our modern life, certainly in many families, perhaps too much so. But in the ancient world, quite the reverse was true. Children were regarded as dispensable objects. You know, a Roman father could murder his child with no fear of prosecution. And in the Greek world, well, here is a phrase from a letter which archaeologists have found from a first century husband working away from home. It's addressed to his pregnant wife. He writes simply, "If it is a girl, my dear, throw it away." That's quite literal. Unwanted children regularly finished up on city rubbish heaps in the ancient world. Jewish society was not significantly superior in this respect. Its true infanticide was much rarer, but children were still disregarded. They still had no social importance whatsoever. But there are several incidents that make very clear that Jesus, in startling contrast to the cultural norms of his day, entertained this enormous respect for children, this enormous concern and affection for children. He believed there was a particular quality about children that the adult world needed to emulate. What was that quality? Well, some have suggested it was their innocence and their purity. But, of course, there's no evidence for that in the text here, is there? In fact, of course, the Bible never really teaches us to regard children as innocent. It teaches instead the rather unpopular doctrine of original sin. No doubt there is much behaviour in the world that is learned, but as William Golding in that famous novel of his, Lord of the Flies, observed, if you put a company of children on a perfect desert island, they do not end up building a paradise on earth. They are much more likely to spoil it and turn into a murderous rabble, because moral weakness is hardwired into us human beings from birth. Now, Jesus is not encouraging us to emulate the innocence of children. Nor, I think, is he encouraging us to copy the simplicity of children's faith. That again has been suggested, that our faith should be as unquestioning as a child's. But that can't be right, because again, the Bible nowhere extols gullibility. In fact, the Apostle Paul exhorts Christians not to be immature babes who can be easily duped by any bogus preacher who comes along. In understanding, he says, be men. So we're not to run away from intellectual problems into childlike credulity. We have to wrestle with our doubts. To fail to wrestle with our doubts is the abdication of faith, not its affirmation. So what is Jesus encouraging us to copy, to emulate in children? Well, we've already identified it. He's making a point about the nature of Christian greatness, a very paradoxical, counterintuitive point. Christian greatness, he says, is not to be assertive. It is not to be pushy or arrogant. On the contrary, Christian greatness is self-effacing, gentle, meek, like a child. Christian greatness, he says, is not to be pretentious, not to be snobbishly obsessed with rank. It is to be modest and unassuming, like a child. The problem with you, my disciples, he says, is you are all obsessed with your image. How do others see you? Well, reckon on this. In the paradoxical topography of the kingdom of God, The way up is down. If you want to be somebody in heaven, you must be willing to be a nobody. Heavenly values are the reverse of those in this world. You cannot get there, still less will you enjoy being there, without a huge change in your attitude in this respect. And that's where children have an advantage over you. For they are already humble. It's much easier for a child to repent. They have fewer steps to retrace, fewer years to regret. You can't repent without a monumental humiliation of your ego. The older you are, the prouder you become, and the harder it is for you to enter the kingdom of heaven. The more wedded you become to your own dignity, your own rights, your own reputation, in a word, your own ego. And of course, nothing illustrates the truth of this mental inertia which accompanies adult pride than what immediately follows from Jesus' little story here in the Gospel of Mark. Because scarcely has Jesus' commendation of childlike humility come out of his mouth than the disciple John bursts in to show he has completely failed to take it on board. See what he says. "Teacher, we saw a man driving out demons in your name, and we told him to stop because he wasn't one of us." See how subtly there egoism is parading itself as a zeal. "We know we're special, Jesus. You've chosen us, haven't you, for a unique role in your kingdom. You haven't empowered everybody to cast out demons, have you? Just us. So we were naturally indignant when we saw this freelance exorcist capitalizing on your name. We told him straight, 'You're not one of us. Jesus is our master, not yours. Stop usurping our prerogatives. Who do you think you are?'" It is difficult to know how far the disciples' concern about the activities of this guy might have been legitimate. We do encounter later in the book of Acts Jewish exorcists who use the name of Jesus like some kind of magical incantation. And it's not impossible this was an early example of that kind of rather pseudo-Christian superstition. But even if that were the case, even if this guy's theology was a bit adrift, Jesus goes on to point out that the 12 were quite wrong to censure him so severely. He wasn't doing any great harm. In fact, John seems to imply, I think, that this guy was enjoying some success in his deliverance ministry. Which would have been a painful irony if so, because the disciples, if you know your Gospel of Mark, you'll be aware of this, the disciples had recently suffered a humiliating failure in precisely this area. Back in Mark 9, verse 18, they had tried to cast out a demon and failed. Maybe the intensity of their indignation with this guy was in part a response to that incident. Were they still licking the wounds of their pride over that? At the very least, Jesus makes it clear they were grossly overreacting. Compared to the homicidal conspiracy that was gathering around him as he approached to Jerusalem, this anonymous healer was an ally. "He's on our side," says Jesus. "Give him the benefit of the doubt. Climb down off your high horse, John. Don't stand so pompously on your apostolic dignity. He's not doing any harm. If he's not against us, treat him as one who's for us. You can't keep the circle of Christian ministry just limited to your own number, you know. Neither do you have to be afraid that some outsider is going to usurp your apostolic privileges." No, remember the lesson of the child. If you forfeit your place of heavenly honor, it is not going to be because others have elbowed their way impertinently in front of you. That isn't the way heaven works. That's why this child has been set in the midst. If on the day of judgment others receive more reward than you do, it is because they have been more willing to serve others in humility of heart than you have. quite a challenge, isn't it? Quite a challenge. It must have been a very sobering challenge for George MacDonald's elitist, intellectualist, high-ranking friends when they heard him preach this way. What can we learn from it? What areas of application do we need to make from a passage like this for today? There are a number of things that suggest themselves to me. I just put them to you for you to maybe discuss over lunch. Pick the one that interests you, and over dinner rather, and see which one you want to pursue further. One obvious area of application concerns our attitude towards children. It is an enormous tribute to the importance of children in Jesus' eyes that he should have used this little child this way. As I say, we take the importance of children perhaps too much for granted these days. The human rights of children are not in dispute, at least not in Western countries. There's even a United Nations declaration on the point, isn't there? Our only controversy in the West surrounds whether those rights of children should be extended to fetuses and to embryos as well as to living infants. It's very hard for us to imagine how any civilized society could possibly treat children badly. Well, I'll tell you something. In my country, in George MacDonald's country, in George MacDonald's lifetime, the age of consent for sexual intercourse was fixed for the first time at 16 years. So in the 1890s, late in the 19th century, that was first done. What was the reason for that piece of legislation? I'll tell you. Because a report discovered in 1885 that there were hundreds of 12-year-old prostitutes of both sexes on the streets of London. George MacDonald's London. And that in the docks, there were ships stuffed with abducted children destined for the sex trade in Europe. This was in proud, respectable Victorian England. The rights of the child are far from self-evident, even to civilized minds, you know. We do well to reflect on how urgently Jesus stresses the importance of honouring children in the Gospels. See how he goes on in verse 42, the passage we might have spent a little longer talking about if we had time. If anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him to be thrown into the sea with a large millstone tied round his neck. Child abuse, whether in the family or sadly in the church, is in the newspapers these days. We do well to take Jesus' warning very seriously. So there is something here that we need to think about in regard to our attitude towards children. There's also, of course, an area of application, isn't there, in regard to the judgments we make about other Christians and other churches. He's not one of us. Now, there's a phrase we hear often enough. He's not a Baptist. He's not one of us. He can't speak at our convention. He's not a charismatic. He's not one of us. He's not welcome in our church. She's a lesbian. She's not one of us. She certainly can't come. He prays from a prayer book. That's not right. He's not one of us. And so it goes on, and it goes on. The Christian world is full of those who would like to turn the church into their own private club, full of people like us. Well, notice, Jesus doesn't like it. Because he perceives the proud, self-obsessed spirit that lies behind such exclusiveness. He puts the child in the midst. Whoever isn't against us is for us, he says. Stop protecting your territory, Christian, and start opening your heart. An application to the judgments we make about other Christians and other churches. I think, too, an area that interests me particularly is the whole question of eternal rewards. I think that comes up here. You see, I had a problem with eternal rewards when I was a young Christian. It seemed to me very discreditable that God should offer eternal rewards to anybody, that he should try to extract a voluntary response from people by means of inducements. You know, believe in me and you can go to heaven. Well, if that's so, what is heaven but a kind of religious bribe? And as for hell, what is that but a kind of religious blackmail? Surely God ought to be above such corrupt practices, I thought. Indeed, such promotional tactics must surely attract people to religion for all the wrong reasons. You know, they must become Christians out of a mercenary coveting of eternal reward or a slavish fear of eternal punishment. I didn't like that at all. It didn't seem to me at all consonant with the rest of the New Testament. I was a great admirer of that hymn by Francis Xavier, the great Catholic. My God, I love thee, not because I hope for heaven thereby. Do you know that hymn? My God, I love thee, not because I hope for heaven thereby, nor because those who love thee not are lost eternally. Not for the sake of winning heaven, nor of escaping hell, not with the hope of gaining aught, nor seeking a reward, but solely because thou art my God and my eternal King. Fine words, I thought. Well said, Francis. Faith can't be a bargain. We strike with God on the basis of some calculated profit margin. It's an unconditional surrender to the claim of God's truth on our conscience. That's how I thought as a young Christian, and in many respects I still think exactly like that. If God is God, then no matter what the advantages or the disadvantages of yielding to his rule might be, integrity ought to demand we honour him for that. And in that sense, the hope of heaven and the dread of hell should be irrelevant to our discipleship. However, I have to say, my sort of youthful idealism on this point has been substantially modified, not by cynicism, but by words of Jesus. I've been struck again and again by the way Jesus regularly uses the thought of heaven, and indeed the thought of hell, as an incentive, and he does so without any trace of embarrassment, without any sense that he's sort of corrupting our motives by talking about this. And, you know, this study passage, if you were to read the whole of it, is a case in point. He's talking here about losing a reward or keeping it. Doesn't he perceive the crude vulgarity in a goodness that's sustained by incitements and menaces? Doesn't he agree with Emerson that virtue is its own reward? It's very difficult to imagine how the moral superiority of those sentiments of Xavier, that love of God is highest, which depends upon no motives of self-interest, square with what Jesus is saying about everybody who gives this cup of water to the least of my little ones is going to get their reward. But no, actually, my early fears on this were all misplaced. Think about it. If Jesus were offering heavenly rewards to the sort of people who made such rewards their goal, then there might indeed be a risk. But the whole point of this passage is that it is the humble that God is pledged to reward, never the proud. In heaven, the way up is down. And that means that people like John, who are motivated by selfish desire for heavenly honours and want to protect their exclusive claim to those honours by demoting others to second place or even excluding them altogether, they are going to find that those so-called less significant disciples they were so keen to disparage actually have gained the rewards. And they have forfeited them. These less significant disciples have gained the reward, not because they sought the rewards, but precisely because they didn't seek them. See, they were humbly giving out cups of cold water in self-forgetfulness, while others were going around sniping at rival ministers and trying to keep them in their proper place. It's those who are prepared, says Jesus, to welcome children, the insignificant ones, the ones that bestow no honour, to minister in menial ways that seem to make you a servant rather than a master. Those who are pursuing no ego trip then, who have no pretensions to greatness, they are the ones who are going to find to their eternal surprise that although they were despised in this world maybe, they will be honoured in the next. That's how Jesus believes it will be. The last, he says, will be first, and the first will be last. So conversely, those who in their pride have no time for tiresome, insignificant little people, or for thirsty saints, come to that, it is they who will find themselves ignored, or maybe even lost. What was it Jesus said to the rejected goats on his left hand? Inasmuch as you did it not to one of the least of these, you did it not to me. It's a sobering thought, then, about the question of eternal rewards, and an insight, I think, as to how it is the New Testament can offer rewards without fostering the very kind of mercenary spirit it elsewhere wants to discourage. The rewards are for the people who aren't looking for them. There's a paradox for you. But perhaps most important of all for a company of men like us, this passage has something to say about the whole issue of Christian leadership, I think. It's a question that's been on my mind for a while because I used to be a leader of a church, and for the last few years I've had to get used to the position of having no leadership role at all, anywhere. It's a steep learning curve, that. What do we learn about leadership from what Jesus has to say about the child in the midst? Well, I think, first of all, taking on board what he says will change the way we appoint leaders. If we're wise, I think what Jesus says here will make us suspicious of the pushy types who volunteer too readily for office in the church. Maybe the best leaders will be the ones who are a little reluctant to accept leadership, who feel instinctively the spiritual danger implicit in the prominence into which leadership will thrust them. Maybe the best leaders are those who are inclined to refuse promotion if they can, on the grounds that whilst it may increase their prestige, there are other things more important in their personal ministries that they would have to sacrifice, like cups of water for little children. Another great Scotsman, Henry Drummond, was urged by Prime Minister Gladstone in Victoria's England to stand for Parliament. But you know he declined. And the reason he gave, he said the humble work he was doing as a pastor in Scotland was more important. And it will change the way we appoint leaders. It will also, I think, change the way we exert leadership. Let's suppose that some of us here are leaders in congregations. Won't Jesus' teaching here transform our whole notions of power? Remember, John F. Kennedy once was asked why he wanted to be president, and he replied, "That's because that's where the power is." Which I suppose is a fair enough answer if you're a politician, because power can be used for good. But I wonder if actually Kennedy was right to think that power is located in the office of the White House. Because after all, Jesus never won an election, did he? Jesus never sat on a throne. Jesus never commanded an army. The only crown he ever wore was made of thorns. The only palace he ever entered was as a prisoner. But can you tell me of any president or any king or any general who has influenced the world more than he has done? And he has done it, you see, not with the whip of political or military power, but by the example of his self-sacrificial service. Jesus Christ has exerted the incomparable influence over the history of the world he has done from a cross. We follow a crucified king. And a crucified king threatens nobody, oppresses nobody, coerces nobody. A crucified king does not demonstrate power. His is a leadership which is offered to free men and women, people whose self-determination is never compromised. Political power never does that, does it? Political influence, even of the most democratic and benevolent and enlightened kind, is always implicitly coercive, whether they do it with the iron fist or the velvet glove. As Jesus said in one place, the rulers of the Gentiles always lord it over others. But he says, that isn't how it must be among you. He who would be the greatest among you must be the servant of all. And I think taken on board, the way we exert leadership within the Christian community will be greatly influenced by this child in the midst. And perhaps too, it will change the way we respond to the leadership of others. I don't know what your observation is, but I notice people can feel very resentful when somebody is appointed to an office in the church they feel they should have got. You know that? We don't like playing second fiddle in somebody else's orchestra. Well, if we take on board what Jesus says here about the child in the midst, we won't be found whining about our rights or standing on our dignity. We won't be found fomenting revolution among the malcontents in the back pews. No, like John the Baptist, we will be glad to acknowledge that a colleague must increase while we must decrease and feel no shame in that confession. The child in the midst will teach us that. I fear too many of us Christians have been seduced by the desire for rank. We've learnt it from the world. And as a result, we have cluttered the church with ecclesiastical hierarchy. We've turned the congregation of God's people into a political arena where people vie for power and prestige and rank, just as these disciples were doing. And why? Well, we have psychologists and psychotherapists amongst us, so I'm a little anxious about trying to express reasons for human motivation. But could it be that we are so concerned about rank because actually we are so insecure, so neurotically obsessed with ourselves in this narcissistic culture of ours? What impression am I making? What image am I projecting? Whatever happens, don't let me lose face. Could it be that's why there is so much rivalry and competitiveness? Isn't this actually the emotional engine that drives all that workaholic obsession with ambition and status that fuels downtown New York and downtown Washington and the city of London? Isn't this the psychological need behind every glossy advertisement in our status-conscious consumerist society? We're all so desperate to be somebody, to prove that we are successful, achieving heroic. And do you know the irony of that? The more fixed our mind is on those values of ambition and success and achievement, the more inaccessible does humility become. Now, I'm reminded of that little book that Charles Spurgeon wrote, Humility and How I Achieved It. See, this is the trouble with humility. It's the one virtue you can't be proud of. Try to attack humility by direct ambition. Try to obey the text, be humble, and you never can. For humility is by definition about self-forgetfulness. Don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting it has to do with a low self-image or an inferiority complex or any of those things that some people struggle to the psychiatrist about. It's not a case of thinking little of yourself. It's a case of not actually having to think about yourself very much at all. But of course, only a very secure person can afford to take the risk of that kind of self-forgetfulness. The insecure person has to think about themselves all the time. Maybe that's why in our, say, narcissistic culture, it's so rare to find real humility. Plenty of low self-image, plenty of inferiority complexes. But humility, you don't come across it very often. Well, Jesus would deliver us from the futile search for self-esteem based on achievement. And he would secure us in the self-esteem of a little child wrapped around by his arms and assured they are important to him. What was it he said? Take my yoke upon you and learn of me. I am meek and lowly in heart. And you will find rest for your souls. Once again, we'll take a few moments of quietness for us to think through what we want to remember. George MacDonald, in an insightful section in one of his sermons, points out that so many of us think about spirituality and religion as a matter of doing. But he says, actually, it's about being. It's not about what we achieve, it's about who we are. Maybe it would help us to think of ourselves as that little child with Jesus' arms wrapped around us, secured, ennobled, dignified. Maybe if we could hold that picture in our hearts, make it the focus of our self-identity, maybe humility, the self-forgetfulness of a child, would just spontaneously happen to us without us having to make it happen at all.